So I'd like to welcome you all to the first watch party event that we've hosted. My name is Louise Arimatsu. I'm a research fellow based at the LSE's Center for Women, Peace and Security. We've made a minor change to the format in that I'm running through the preliminary housekeeping matters rather than Professor Chinkin, who will instead be taking an active part in the panel discussions following the film. In terms of format, we've set aside 90 minutes in total for the event. The film runs for approximately 20 minutes. At the close of the film, Professor Tina Dolgopol, our moderator, will be introducing the panelists who have been asked, among other things, to reflect on the film itself, as well as on the broader legacies of the tribunal. About 40 minutes has been set aside for that conversation. We are, of course, keen to hear your views too. So we urge you to use the chat function on Zoom to share your views and to pose questions to the panel. During the last 30 minutes of the event, Tina will be turning to your questions and comments. For technical reasons, and as is standard practice, your videos have been turned off and your audio muted. That said, I would also like to draw your attention to the fact that this entire event is being recorded and will be posted online, including the Q&A session. So if you wish to stay anonymous but would like to engage with us, please feel free to contact us outside the event. Now, this event and the film that we're about to watch together was made possible by grant from the European Research Council to the Gender Peace Project, a four-year research project led by Professor Christine Chinkin. This project has given us, as scholars, an opportunity to think critically about what a gender peace might look like and how such a vision or visions might be secured, including through international law. And so it was with this context in mind that we decided to revisit what happened two decades ago, to a moment in time when the potential for international law to deliver a gender-just peace was realized, albeit fleetingly. When a group of women who shared a belief in the transformative potential of the law took action, confronted by the catastrophic failure on the part of states to do what should have been done decades earlier. This was not the first people's tribunal, although it was the first women's tribunal of its kind. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce our moderator, Professor Tina Dolgopol, who is in fact the leading authority on people's tribunals. She was, of course, also one of the chief prosecutors for the Tokyo Women's International War Crimes Tribunal, and over the last two decades has written and spoken about the search for redress by the comfort women. Tina will be leading the discussions following the film. We hope that the film and the discussions will serve to inform, to inspire, to prompt questions, debates, and even motivate a new generation of activists to work to secure gender justice and a gender just peace. Thank you.
This is an instance where women, non-governmental organizations, did what governmental organizations failed to do, even though there was sufficient evidence. And that is an opportunity to set the record straight.
When the Second World War ended, although the Allied forces knew that there were women who were kept in sexual slavery, patriarchal standards dominated, and crimes against women were just hidden.
I'll pay for it. We are marching on the street. There's no time, it's a time, I mean, listen. They are already old.
These women were all in their 80s when they started to come out. They were sick and they were dying. One of the comfort women said, you know, I'm coming out because I need to get my soul back before I die.
Litigation was being commenced both in the Japanese court and in courts abroad, and essentially was getting nowhere.
By 1998, you know, we were really frustrated that nothing legal was moving.
Many of the women had come forward. They would talk about the horrific experiences. Academics would then talk about why those were breaches of international law. Activists would talk about what they wanted to do, but there didn't seem to be a change in the international community. And the women realized that if they were ever going to have some sense of formal justice, that organizing a people's tribunal would be the best way to go.
The people's tribunal is created by and for civil society. It's an assertion that law is not just for states, it's also for people. And in the case of this tribunal, women's civil society.
This idea came from Japanese activist and journalist, Yayori Matsui.
Yayori Matsui came to me and said, Indai, we have to organize a war crimes tribunal. And it's really a tall order.
She was very aware that we are perpetrator country. That's the reason why we should do.
I said to Yayori immediately, sure, why not? Okay. Just like that, no question. But that is how I think history is made. You don't ask too many questions. You just say, okay, let's do it.
I was asking Yayori after the tribunal, how come you could get that such a high profile judges and chief prosecutors?
I'm a civil rights lawyer who became an international judge. I went to law school in the turbulent 1960s in the United States for the express purpose of being a civil rights lawyer. So this gave me an opportunity to kind of renew my passion in my youth, as well as perhaps filling some gaps that I knew existed in the state of international criminal law at that time.
I decided to join it myself as being a descendant of a slave. And everyone in the United States who's a descendant of a slave is more than likely a descendant of a female slave who has been sexually enslaved. So for me, there was a very natural connection on a personal level. In addition to, this was really the area of my professional legal interest at that time.
One of the reasons I was willing to be involved in the tribunal is that there was this sense in which Japan would never truly admit what had happened during the Second World War. And it just seemed like doing something that was more formal might have a greater impact.
I got a phone call asking me if I would be involved and if I would consider becoming one of the panel of judges. The very fact that this was an initiative of a number of different women's organizations across Asia, and so that it was very much coming from them. I mean, it was a huge honor to be asked by such people.
They were looking for a man because they had three women already. I was working with Kenya Human Rights Commission, where we were doing fantastic work on women's rights, gay rights. They asked me if I would, like to serve, and I said, yes, I was ready.
The legal experts and scholars were what we now know and call allies. This was the start of my sort of human rights career. And just looking over the 20 years, this for me was one of the most incredible moments when civil society women leaders and activists, when legal scholars, when legal experts from around the globe, everybody came to Tokyo.
We called it the Women's International War Crimes Tribunal. It was led by women. It was about the issue of women, you know. It was not a Yugoslavia war crimes tribunal or a Rwanda war crimes tribunal. It was a women's tribunal that addressed one core issue, and that is sexual slavery, rape, mass rape, sexual violence, forced pregnancy in wartime.
One of the things that really set this particular People's Tribunal apart was the formal nature of the proceedings. That really came from the women. They felt that this was the only way that they would feel that they had justice. If something that had that very formal nature to it came to the conclusion that what had happened to them was a crime.
Over in Tokyo, Japanese war criminals faced their trial led by...
We lived in certain myths about what happened in World War II. And if it didn't get to the Tokyo Tribunal, it didn't exist. Of course, we don't remember what was absent and what by all means could have and should have been there.
The framing of the tribunal was as a continuation of the International Military Tribunal for the Far East.
We took a decision to only use the law that was applicable in 1945 to show that this very evidence at that time, in 1945-46, could have been adjudicated. The forum existed, the crimes had been committed, and could have been the basis of a conviction.
Yes, there will be high military officials who are named in the indictments, as well as the Emperor Hirohito.
Organizing the Women's International War Crimes Tribunal was really one of a kind.
They worked across 10 countries to find the teams of prosecutors.
In order to work together among 10 countries, of course, there were lots of very tense moments.
You think about lawyers from 10 different jurisdictions discussing with one another exactly how this is going to work. You can just imagine the discussions that took place.
I could see them struggling and then achieving the ability to work harmoniously. And the fact that North and South Korea decided to become one team, I mean, that was just like, my gosh, and I was there.
I can't stress enough the amount of work that went into this by
historians and researchers digging into the military archives till 8 o'clock.
Everybody was working all the time. So there were at times so many different legal advisors, legal assistants, legal scholars, and
diaries, as well as additional war documents. Other people were searching archives in London.
There were hundreds of people behind the scene who worked towards that.
Everybody was able to work through it and, of course, come to an agreement about what the charter for the tribunal would be and an agreement that it would take place in Tokyo.
As you have in many situations of mass atrocities, you have populace and people who deny that those atrocities ever took place.
We were certainly very aware of a great deal of hostility. In Tokyo, we had to be careful going out. I had to be careful going into the tribunal each day.
There were right-wing people demonstrating outside of the venue. Comfort women were prostitutes. Go back to your country, etc. You know, all kinds of hate speech and harassment.
There were people outside not only protesting, but there were threats of harm.
We knew we weren't welcome. And that was the pleasure of that struggle. I felt like I always feel when I'm in a demonstration, you are emboldened, okay? Because you feel this is a cause you can die for.
Holding it in not just Japan, but in Tokyo, in a city that was the city of empire, was courageous, it was brave, it was truth to power. And I think for the survivors and for the women who came forward, it was a means of saying, I am here, I exist.
The opening reminded me of the Tadic trial's opening because of the media, you know, and the number of attendees.
Kudankaikan Hall holds 1,500 people. third tier of that hall was filled with the international media.
The testimonies of the comfort women were really compelling. It was beyond measure to listen for each stories of the women coming from different 9 countries with almost the same story of sexual slavery, how they were abducted, how they were taken from their houses, how they were brought to the Japanese garrison, how they saw their members of their family or their fathers and mothers being killed in front of them and then being dragged to the comfort station and being repeatedly raped every day.
We are joined by country prosecutors. But I asked them to.
I've seen 9 country teams bring forward their individual cases. And Tina and I, as co-prosecutors, we were always on the stage. And so we could see just the buildup of the evidence legally and emotionally. The audience was hearing the culmination of the evidence for the first time. They might have known about one woman or one incident or one country, but all of a sudden, it's like the puzzle pieces were just falling together and the mosaic was being formed. And so when the judges brought their judgment forward, they kind of handed us back the package of rights that had been sought.
Your Honors, I would submit that Emperor Hirohito might use many justifications for the roads to the comfort station. They all lead to slavery and rape. And they all lead him to your judicial wisdom, which means a pronouncement of guilt.
When the judgment was handed down, recognizing that sexual slavery was a crime against humanity. And then the second part of that was the recognition that Emperor Hirohito was responsible for that crime.
I can remember where I was sitting in that hall. I can remember the faces of the survivors. The audience suddenly started clapping and shouting, and people stood up in their chairs. And all the comfort women stood up and were celebrating.
The comfort women went on stage and started crying. We all cried. It was almost like, we achieved justice. We really did. They achieved justice. We too felt we achieved justice. I mean, I remember that stage when all the women were crying, you know, and really crying, hugging each other and waving and saying, yeah, at last, now, you know, justice is done to us. You know, we have achieved justice in our lifetime before we die. I mean, even Patricia Sellers, we were all crying and hugging each other.
And it's not as if we didn't know what the verdict was probably going to be. I mean, that's what we've been working on. But, I mean, your heart was still there the whole time. And so this is when the heart finally had a chance to kind of speak and release. And so I remember that moment as being just all-consuming.
That was televised, that went global. That was a moment of shame. Finally, not their shame, finally shame that globally, this was a failure of accountability on a global scale.
This is the judgment that was handed down. Have you ever seen this? Look, this judgment looks, and purposely looks very similar to the judgments that were issued at the Yugoslav Tribunal at the time, of which I had tens of others. It's a solid, substantive judgment that each of the women received in The Hague, and I remember them clasping it to their breast.
All rise.
The judgment was handed down at The Hague in December 2001. That in itself says quite a lot.
It was never done before, you know, that, you know, a group of women from 9 countries come together and said, This is sexual violence in wartime. This happened 50 years ago and still happening today. What is the international community doing about it?
Given my experience as a human rights activist, I knew, that was the beginning of the struggle for the justice of these women.
Japanese media was very much silenced afterwards. We tried the Emperor Hirohito and announced guilty. After that, it's more kind of backlash becomes much stronger. Politicians intervened, public broadcasting program, before the program showed. The portion that Emperor Hirohito was guilty and was deleted. The testimony of the former soldiers deleted. The survivors from each country deleted. They only left Korean women only. Meaning, they're trying to make the issue between Korea and Japan not something broad.
What happened and what has happened since then, hasn't surprised me, It's the impunity of ruling groups and states and governments in this world.
Yayori had been in hiding for about a month because of the threat from the right wing, threatening phone calls and then, bomb you, etc. Very, dangerous threats.
That right wing movement has continued. There's also been years of a government that's been absolutely unsympathetic to this issue.
Looking back, of course, 9/11 happens. What, 9 months later? That was very much an end to that early optimism of the 1990s and a very changed environment as we then moved into the new century.
In recent times, we have seen around the world a pushback against gender equality and women's rights.
Moving on 2 decades now, a very big pushback against human rights, against women's human rights, against women human rights defenders.
This issue that we tried to resolve at the Women's Tribunal 20 years ago, it's still happening. So without the common concerted efforts, this will not go away.
It is not over. The fight continues till today.
What some people may consider to have been a failure can be a positive because it shows the inaction in the face of an abundance of evidence that is recounted. It shows the continuing failure of the government of Japan to do what it should do, what it can do, and still.
Any freedom, any rights that we are enjoying currently is the result of the struggle of our sisters, our predecessors, our parents' generation.
For every normative framework that is being recognized within the United Nations, there is a movement of women behind it that push for it and fought for it and talk about it. It was not like the United Nations one day said, let's talk about women, peace, and security. No, that never happened. It was the women activists like us out there in the picket lines, putting the rally, talking to the women who were victims of sexual violence that pushed the United Nations to recognize women, peace, and security.
In order to go forward, we need to remember, we need to celebrate what we have achieved so far.
He redefined interpretations of humanitarian law and international law and human rights law. We gendered the whole framework.
It also talks to what justice should look like. It centered victims within that process. And the International Criminal Court has gone on to do that.
Our judgment, the Women's Tribunal judgment, is now being used by the ICC as one of the most gender judgment ever written.
Judges continue that such gender blindness in international peace processes contributes to the continuing culture of impunity for crimes perpetrated against women in armed conflict.
It's a beautiful judgment. It is the most gendered interpretation of humanitarian law and international law. It redefined the notion of what would constitute accountability, compensation, and reparation in wartime.
The International Women's Tribunal kind of pulled the curtain back to show what's always been there, but has been invisible in our legal jurisprudence. And once you open those curtains and see it, there's no going back. There's no going back. You can only go forward and build upon it.
It's my great pleasure to introduce the members of our panel. Professor Christine Schinken is Professorial Research Fellow in the Center for Women, Peace and Security, Professor at the London School of Economics. Professor Schinken is a leading expert on international law and human rights law, especially in international human rights of women. In 2000, her co-authored groundbreaking book with Hilary Charlesworth, The Boundaries of International Law, A Feminist Analysis, examined the status of women in human rights and international law. In 2005, in recognition of this and other contributions, Schinken and Charlesworth were awarded the American Society of International Law Goller T. Butcher Medal for outstanding contributions to the development or effective realization of international human rights law. Jane Gordon is a lawyer with over 20 years experience working in human rights legal practice and policy. In 2014, Jane co-founded Sisters for Change, an international non-government organization working to combat discrimination and violence against women. Before Sisters for Change, Jane was a human rights legal consultant, advising parliamentary select committees, oversight and regulatory authorities across the United Kingdom and Ireland, and litigating cases before the European Court of Human Rights. Jane was a senior fellow at the London School of Economics Human Rights Center and the Center for Women, Peace and Security from 2008 to 2017. From 2013 to 2014, she served as a gender advisor to the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria. Dr. Hsu Shin has been working on women's human rights for 40 years. She successfully led the legislative movements in Korea on sexual and domestic violence, advocated the issue of Japanese military sexual slavery internationally, and served as a member of the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women from 2001 until 2008. Currently, she is chair of the board of directors of the Korea Center for United Nations Human Rights Policy, and is a member of the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. She is also working together with 14 civil society organizations in 8 countries towards inscribing the Comfort Women documents as a UNESCO, part of the UNESCO Memory of the World Heritage. Has been active in the field of human rights from the 1990s and was actively involved in the Women's Tribunal in the year 2000. She was one of the leading figures to establish the Women's Active Museum on War and Peace, better known as WAM, based in Tokyo in 2005, in order to keep the spirit of the Women's Tribunal alive and pass on the records and memories of the Comfort Women system. I would add to that that Yayoi Metoy, who was referred to in the video, Yayoi's estate helped to establish WAM. Mina has been internationally campaigning for the rights of the comfort women, survivors, and written alternative reports for, as well as lobbied at the UN human rights institutions. Welcome to all of you. And also with us is Sophie Mallett, who is the producer of the video that you just watched, and we will be asking Sophie to comment on the video in a little while. I'm going to pose some questions to the panelists. I would like to remind them to please be as succinct as possible. Ideally, answers should be no longer than 3 minutes. And the first question for the panelists is for them to reflect on their immediate reactions to the documentary. And within that, did you learn something new from the other interviewees? Was there anything that surprised you? Did watching the video help to renew your commitment to either the elimination of discrimination against women or to working on issues around the comfort women? So the first speaker will be Jesus Shin. Jesus, can you please unmute yourself? And then following Jesus, yes. It'll be Mina, then Jane, and then Christine.
Yeah. I should start by saying thank you to LSE Center for Women, Peace and Security and to Sophie for making this really wonderful documentary, which showed me the unseen pictures of the judge, Gabrielle McDonald, when she was participating in the civil rights movement as well as herself. It was interesting to see those, unseen participation in the human rights movement. And also, I didn't know that, of course, I knew after the tribunal, there was distortion by Japanese media, but I didn't know in detail, as Mina has just explained in the documentary, that, the very relevant parts were deleted, including those survivors' testimonies from other countries other than Korea, so that it would be seen as a fight between Korea and Japan when it actually involves 8 other victimized countries. So it was really interesting, and I have to thank you, all the more for making this film as well as today's events. So thank you, Christine and Sophie, for your work.
Yeah.
And if I can add, it is really sad to see that Yayoi Matsui, my great mentor and my colleague, and for many years, is no longer with us, as well as many survivors who showed on the documentary film, the Hwang Geum-ju, Moon Pil-gi, and many others who had fought are no longer with us today. They passed away. And in South Korea alone, there are only 16 survivors left out of officially registered 238 survivors. So time has passed. I think what we have really tried was to seek justice for the survivors of sexual slavery by the Japanese military, and which we are still doing it for all the remaining survivors, as well as the survivors of more recent violations in war.
Thank you, Jesus. Mina? Sorry, Mina, can you unmute yourself?
Hello, everyone, and probably good morning for some of them. And thank you, Fortuna, for a kind introduction. And thank you for Christian and all the LSC team for organizing this commemorating event. I'm very honored to join you today. And I'm very glad to be reunited, because I was watching this participants list and I saw the name Susan Makabwag from the Philippines, Cho Si-hyun from the South Korea, Lepa Mladenovic from for Yugoslavia, those who involved in the tribunal are now with us, and it's very very special occasion for me to meet again.
And for the video, first of all, I'd like to congratulate Sophie for making the video within 23 minutes. She was interviewing me for like 1.5 or 2 hours, and she's going to do so for everybody. And I said, 15 minutes, it's impossible. And I was telling her it's so difficult. And I know that how difficult and sometimes even painful it is to cut off the important testimonial comments to make the documentary concise enough to see, to watch. And I was also in a similar position when we made the documentary from the footage for 4 days into 68 minutes. It was very painful to cut off all the testimony of the survivors. And personally, I was very moved also, like Jesus said, to hear the reasons why the judges and chief prosecutors decided to join the Women's Tribunal. I did not know also that Judge McDonald was a civil rights lawyer when she was young. And I remember we did not have any access to the judges at all, because of the very strict regulation when we were during the tribunal. So I couldn't even chat with Christine during the tribunal. So these interviews will be a very important archive of the Women's Tribunal. In retrospect, however, I could have suggested to include the interviews of the survivors who attended the tribunal to ask how they remember or how they think of the tribunal at the moment. Just a few days ago, I was informed that the one Taiwanese survivor passed away. And in Taiwan, only one survivor named Iwao Tanaha, she's a Taroko, indigenous woman, is still alive. And she did participate in the tribunal too. So I don't know how is her health condition, but after 20 years, how the survivors are, looking back the tribunal is something I really, if there's a possibility, I'd have to know. So everybody, I'm so glad that everybody mentioned about Yayori. And I'd like to also add Kazuko Kawaguchi and Tatsue Takashima and Shoji Rutsuko and all others, but if possible, I just suggest to indicate in closing credit that names of the survivors who participated and the country prosecutors and those who played a leading role. Thank you.
Thank you, Mina. Jane, and your reactions.
Thank you, Tina. And hello, everybody. Can I also thank LSE for inviting me to participate in this very important commemoration, and congratulations to Sophie on making the film. I remember when she was interviewing me, she was so full of all of the interviews that she had been doing, but I think all of us realized what a huge job it was to transport and transpose all of that into a very, very accessible and emotional films. So what are my reflections or impressions of the documentary? I suppose once again it really shows that it was such a moment in history. And if you think about the fact that it's 20 years later, the memories and the recollections of all of the people who were interviewed are so sharp and vivid and intense. And I think that goes to the fact of this being really quite an extraordinary moment of time. And I think one of the things that the film pays particular tribute to, and very properly, was the immense courage and the personal dignity of the survivors, of the comfort women, many of whom we've heard are no longer here. So I suppose that's something that strikes me all over again, as well as just the dedication and determination of all of the people involved. And I guess it really does underline the power of the collective, the coming together of some of the most foremost feminist activists and civil society leaders across the Asia Pacific, of legal scholars, of lawyers, of legal experts, to expose what was an unacknowledged wrong at that time. And the power of the collective remains something to be very, very proud of.
Thank you, Jane. Christine?
Thank you, Tina. And first of all, thank you all of you for participating today and for supporting us at the centre in this effort for the documentary. It's quite a reunion, as somebody else said. It's quite wonderful to see everybody again. Didn't we all look young back in the video after 20 years later? There's just so many reflections. I think just to stick with two. One is, as Nina said, there was no contact between the judges and the organisers. The judges were very much kept apart in order essentially for independence, impartiality, etc. And the documentary really brought home to me just that in level of organisation, which was absolutely extraordinary, involving so many people, as Jane has just said, researchers, activists, those who were just committed to the cause of bringing the attention of the world, as somebody else said, it was a global movement, in fact, to the injustices that had occurred and the need for reparation, the need for acknowledgement about what had happened at that time. And again, I think I have to congratulate the organisers some 20 years later. I don't know whether we did at the time or not. But I think the other point that came over very strongly was something Patty Sellers said, the power of hearing so many of the survivors, looking at the documentary evidence, bringing the maps, the diary, is just so much all together. As she said, the pieces came together as a mosaic, and there we saw in its totality what had happened. I do agree very strongly about the idea that we should hear the Comfort Women's voices. And I would just also remember that there is a documentary of the tribunal at the time that's available on YouTube, where there's a great deal of the testimony of the women, which I think is well worth going back and watching again.
Thank you, Christine. I'd like to ask Sophie Mallett, who is the producer of the video, to offer her reflections to everyone this evening on the making of it, perhaps a little bit about her struggles in making decisions and how she developed her storyboard to figure out what would be in and what would be out.
Thanks, Tina. Well, first of all, it was a lot. You know, like we only, like Mina said, we only interviewed a handful of people, and there were so many people in the tribunal that were involved. So from the very beginning, you know, what we were working with was this, and then I had to kind of find this out of it. But it was a huge privilege. It was so nice to be kind of jettisoned into this world and asked to tell the story. And in every interview, there was always a moment where I was getting goosebumps. Like Jane said, it was very present. The memories were really strong. So that was something that I wanted to see whether we could, you know, have stay in the documentary, that kind of strength of impact personally, but also legally, globally, and the legacy of the film. I would say there could have been 1,000 documentaries that we made, even just from the footage that I had available to me. There could have been a documentary on each of the participants, on each of the survivors, on each of the prosecutors. There could have been a documentary on the scandal with the public broadcaster. So this is just one version of the many that exist in multiple universes, hopefully. But there was a couple of things that were a struggle, like you said, Tina, to decide what should be included. And apart from the fact that we really were able to include the choice to make it very formal and to follow kind of a legal jurisprudence that mirrored what was already happening, the charter, the decision to have it in Tokyo, the decision to use the law that existed then. There are a couple of things that a lot of people mentioned that I think are worth mentioning now, which didn't make it into the documentary. And that is this very unique combination of reparation and criminal justice that this tribunal was looking for. A lot of people mentioned that, and I think that would be great to talk more about. Gabrielle talked about having been a judge in the Yugoslav tribunal, for the former Yugoslavia, sorry, that this was actually, that allowed a lot of flexibility, the ability to try someone who had passed away, the ability to center victims. She didn't experience that at The Hague. So that was quite interesting that she felt like, despite the formality, it was actually quite flexible. And I think something that was mentioned a lot by Paddy and by Mina was that there was a very unique gender collaboration. As you see in the documentary footage, there was a lot of gender collaboration, which maybe has been lost in women's struggles. And they both noted that that was something quite unique at that time and quite unique about this particular struggle. So they're the things that lots of people mentioned that were left out, but yeah, it is. It exists. We're very happy. It exists.
And we're very happy, Sophie. So thank you very much. That's great. All right. Sophie, unless you have anything else to say, I might go to some other questions for the panel. Okay. I'd like to ask each of the panel members to reflect on what they understand the legacy of the tribunal to be. And Nina, I'd like to start with you.
Wow, I thought I'm going to be the last.
No such luck.
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, everybody in the video also, everybody put the legacy very in a beautiful way. So I don't feel like I have to add one thing. But one thing I wrote down that through the tribunal process, the people of Asia-Pacific and concerned professionals from five continents critically reviewed international law, which had been West-centered and male-centered historically, and reconstruct and reinterpret the law from the perspectives of gender and colonialism. That's something, one of the kind of legacy that I put in a very short sentence. But secondly, the legacies, I think the establishment of WAM itself is a legacy. And I believe that is the reason why I was invited here today. As Everest mentioned, Yayoi always emphasized that Women's Tribunal was proposed by women in the perpetrating state, Japan, and conducting the capital of that state in order to take a responsibility as Japanese citizens. And as you remember, the venue was next to Yasukuni Shrine, the famous war shrine. Tremendous efforts were needed on the side of Japanese civil society too. And as Sophie was mentioned, not only women, but also men very much made an effort to make the tribunal possible. And after the tribunal, Yayoi passed away due to the cancer in 2002 and left the will to establish Women's Museum to keep the records and the spirit of the tribunal. And in terms of the spirit, the WAM, the museum focusing on violence against women in war, especially comfort women issue, was established right after, 5 years after the tribunal, with donation mainly from people in Japan. And for 15 years, we were running the museum independently without any funds from the Japanese government. So you see in my book that there are portraits of 179 victim survivors of Kompo women from 10 countries and regions who gave us permission to exhibit their photos. Now, portraying the whole system spread in the Asia Pacific is also the legacy of the tribunal. And one other specific aspect that I have to mention is the impact of pronouncing Emperor Hirohito guilty for the crimes against humanity in Japan. If not, it was probably regarded as another IMTFE, and NHK scandal wouldn't have happened. One of the right-wing activists was saying that they had underestimated the tribunal because it was something organized by ladies. I think it was very compliment. But having said that, what I agree with the comments about all the legacies with the global and universal implication for justice and women's rights, but as a citizen of the perpetrating state of Japan, I feel I should refrain from focusing only on the positive legacies at this moment, when none of the recommendations
of the Women's Tribunal fulfilled, and the revisionism and denialism led by the politicians are getting worse, even compared to the year 2000.
Therefore, Mina, I think we're going to have to turn it over to some of the other panelists for a moment, unless you only
one sentence.
Okay.
And other questions, I don't speak much.
We'll see.
Yeah, we need to, because I want to emphasize about the last legacy we have to make or we have to establish is that the liberal precedent in history that government has to be held accountable for the sexual violence it committed in a war, even after 75 years or even 100 years have passed, because it hasn't established yet. Thank you, Tina, for your...
I warned everybody I would be a strict moderator.
I have to talk a little bit about WAM, and WAM probably if it doesn't know, so I thought I have to explain a little bit. And for other questions, I will be silent, sorry.
No silence allowed. Before I move on, I was given permission, even as the moderator, to make a couple of comments. And I'd just like to follow up something that Mina said about the donations, because it's something that's often overlooked in all of this, that there's often been a divergence between the population in Japan and the government of Japan. Because when I first started working on this issue in 1993, and after that, I would go to Tokyo every couple of years to attend seminars and conferences on the issue. The amount of money that was raised by the general population in Japan was extraordinary. And initially, before the organizations in each of the countries where women had experienced the comfort women system were able to convince their governments to give support, enormous sums of money were raised in Japan to for medical expenses, to set up community centers for the women. I remember going through the Tokyo subway and seeing women and men with little badges on them asking for donations for support for the comfort women. And it also should be said that a part of the cost of the tribunal was money that was actually raised in Japan. So I think people need to keep in mind sometimes that governments may take one attitude, but their population might actually have another attitude. So that you can't just say the Japanese. You have to think very carefully in a nuanced way about this discussion and what it means within the context of Japan itself. All right, having said my piece, on to Jane.
Thank you, Tina. So in terms of the legacy of the tribunal, for me, I would say it's a redefining of both the legal and historical record, and that can't be overlooked. So at base, we have the state of Japan and Emperor Hirohito being found guilty of crimes against humanity under international law applicable in 1945. And that was crimes of sexual slavery, rape, trafficking, forced labor, state orchestrated, state sponsored, state administered. And I, as legal assistant to Christine at the time of the tribunal, we were focusing on writing the paper on the responsibility of the state of Japan. But also then redefining the historical record. And I think this is where the survivors had an incredible role in terms of breaking the silence. I think also not only exposing the gender blindness of military tribunals, of peace processes, but also in who is allowed to speak and whose memories are validated in the historical record. And I think that is something that will never be taken away now, making visible sexual violence, sexual slavery in armed conflict, and demanding accountability, I suppose, both not only of the perpetrator state, but also of the global community, because there was, as I said in that film, there was a global failure to take action to prosecute Japanese officials at the end of World War II, despite the evidence of widespread sexual slavery. So I think for me, it's the redefining of that record has been critical. And whilst I recognize the formal justice systems, both in the country and in other countries where there has been litigation have been inadequate, I think this shows the power of having other informal mechanisms that can break the silence and can expose those wrongs.
Thank you. Christine, you need to unmute yourself.
Sorry. Building very much on what Jane just said, I think I would emphasize first the way in which the tribunal was organized and then the judgment was set out indicated for lawyers that state responsibility, human rights law, and international criminal law, individual criminal liability need not be separated, and that the two are very much to be seen together, and that especially when one looks at it from the perspective of the survivors, which of course is what the tribunal was focused on, then there is those legal categorizations don't make any sense. And the importance of getting the totality of the legal picture, the one hand, the violations of human rights, the right to reparations and compensation, on the other hand, the assertion of individual criminal liability and going right to the top, and the fact that those at the top cannot hide behind their position, I think is an extremely important legal analysis. And then also to build as a second legacy on something else Jane just said. She talked about the historical record. I think another aspect of the historical record is the history of women's activism. And I think that we saw very strongly through the documentary that the coming together in the year 2000, while it may have been unprecedented in terms of setting up the tribunal, it built upon a long history of activism. And activism that goes back certainly to the First World War and then further comes on through the civil rights movement, again, as we saw, through other movements that are fighting injustice and fighting injustice, whether it's on the grounds of gender, on the grounds of race, on the grounds of poverty. We see the coming together of these different ways in which a real analysis of gender justice has to take account of all of these various different strands. And I think that while, as several people have said, the actual specific issue has not been resolved in the way that we hoped in 2000, these other aspects can only go forward, as Judge McDonald said.
Hey Sue, would you like to comment? Thank you.
Well, already three people ahead of me put it very beautifully, but I would again want to emphasize that, you know, the building together to make this tribunal a success, especially between the perpetrator country, Japan's women's rights movement, as well as the nine other victimized countries, you know, that was really remarkable. We always have worked together with the women's movement in Japan, led by Yayoi Matsui, but many others, you know, who participated. We overcame the separation that, oh, you are the perpetrator country, you know, women, or oh, we are the victimized country. But we really worked together. And I think I want to pay tribute to the Japanese women's movement. And as shown in the film, we overcame also the divided Koreas into North and South. So North and South worked together as a one team. And I think that also applies to Indonesia, the Netherlands, as well as East Timor, who share all these colonial experience of, you know, being invaded and being ruled, etc. And also China and Taiwan. So I think all these working together for almost 3 years to make this a success was a great, a great achievement that only women's movement and civil society movement can achieve. No, you cannot see this in any other area. And one more thing is, we worked with the survivors, you know, who survivors, and 64 survivors attended the tribunal. And then there was a sense of sharing and solidarity between the survivors group as well as the human rights, women's rights group. And nowadays, a very much talked about topic is survivor-centered approach. And maybe there is a room that we could have made this tribunal give more space to the survivors. But in a tribunal format, of course, something is not possible, you know. But I think this sense of solidarity, and after three-year work, we all had real sense of relief and sense of achievement, sense of satisfaction by having finished this big event. Yeah.
It definitely was a sense of joy and satisfaction. Thank you, Haesu. I'm going to turn up, receive some questions from our audience, and thank you to the people who've been sending in the questions. The first question comes from somebody who comes from Syria and who has been aware of the Tokyo Women's Tribunal, and that person, as well as other people they're working with, have used the Tokyo Tribunal as a reference point for their work. And their specific question is, Syrian CSOs already struggle with funding for any justice-related work. How were the organizers able to fund the tribunal for such a scale? And I'll ask both their questions. And Mina and Haesu, you probably are in the best position to talk about the funding. And the second part of the question is there a roadmap or advice the panelists can give us as Syrian activists on how to work on justice for sexual and gender-based violence survivors, taking into consideration the political climate surrounding the Syrian conflict, such as the involvement of veto powers in the conflict, and obviously presumably referring to the UN Security Council in that. And maybe for the second question, Jane, you might start off the discussion given your involvement in the inquiry in Syria, and then perhaps Christine can comment following Jane. All right, so for the first part of the funding, Haesu, did you want to start? Because, you know, the Korean Council at the time put in a huge effort into raising money for the tribunal.
Actually money was a big obstacle, and I think that we set the target fundraising money for the whole event, $500,000, and then for the Japanese organizer, $200,000, Korea, $100,000, et cetera, et cetera. And in Korea, we did everything. Of course, we collected money from individuals. There was a concert who voluntarily had a series of concerts to raise money. We sold the items imported from North Korea. We sold badges. At the end, I think we charged it for the participants of the tribunal every day, each day, one day participation, 3,000 yen. And then I was dealing with the media people. I was coordinator of the media team, and I was giving a press conference two times a day for the 200 media people. And they complained to me, how can you charge a reporter for attending this conference? But it was the decision of the international organizing committee. So I think funding is a big obstacle. When there is a will, you have to squeeze out every creative ideas. No, of course, the Philippine team got some funding from the International Funding Agency. So you try everything from collecting, you know, real petty money from the general public, but all sorts of selling and but there were many volunteers. I think the key thing is, how can you mobilize people's participatory spirit for the cause? I think that's the big secret that you can get fundraising. But money is a big problem. Yeah, I agree.
Thanks. Mina?
I think I was trying to make, this is, can you see? No, I don't think you can see.
No, it's not very clear.
I'm not also in charge of the fundraising, so I probably for the December 10th, you know, the Inda is going to be a speaker, so she would be the best person to ask the fundraising. But in terms of the Japanese team to fund, to collect money, because in Japan, we don't have fundraising organization like United States or Europe. So basically what we do is to ask donation, a participatory donation to the each group for this cause. And from this list, we have 298 organizations supported the tribunal from Japan, only from Japan. And which is really from small organization who has been, which has been supported the lawsuits by, for example, the Filipino Council for Women or Taiwanese Council for Women, or, and also from many Christian organizations and civil society organizations. So that's probably from Japan, the source of the funding. And also from like a NOVIBO, you know, those funding agencies. And that is, I think, the amount of, big amount of money came from too. So altogether, how much, I don't know at this moment. I have to see the documents. So that's what I can say at this moment. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mina. I think for somebody from Syria, the chances of raising the money internally are not great. But that point about the philanthropic organizations, both within Europe as well as within the United States, and also going to like NOVIP is the Dutch government funded organization, but they do support non-government organizations in their work. So some of it is putting in that hard yards of doing your research of what philanthropic organizations and other bodies might be willing to fund such an effort. And sometimes starting small and moving larger. If you're based, the only other thing I'll say before I pass on to Christine and Jane, is I went to a seminar for the people who had organized the Iran Tribunal. I think they were actually able to raise money from some rather wealthy English barristers to help them. So if you are based in the UK, approaching the English bar may not necessarily be a bad idea. Now, Jane, did you want to start us off on the second part of that question, unless you have anything to add about suggestions for funding?
No, I don't think anything else to add on funding. In terms of a roadmap or advice on how to work for justice for sexual violence victims. So first of all, I would say that we must pay tribute to civil society organizations in Syria who have been at the forefront of documenting human rights violations, humanitarian law and international criminal law violations. I suppose the most practical thing is documenting and collecting evidence, certainly for the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, which has been now ongoing for over a decade. All of the evidence that has been gathered, the interviews that have been conducted, will be, are being stored and will be passed when there is eventually some kind of justice mechanism. So there is that need for, just like we've been discussing today, the documentation, the collection of evidence. So that's one. The other side is, remember that the state of Syria has a continuing human rights obligation under international law in terms of the investigation of rape, torture, human rights violations. This is something that I don't think has come out as well from the Commission of Inquiry, but obviously it's an ongoing, a continuing failure to investigate, and that therefore gives some positivity, I guess, for the length of time of the conflict, but that afterwards there will be those obligations at the state level, even if there is a weaker form of international tribunal, because there has been a lot of debate as to whether it would happen in the state of Syria or it would happen outside. So I would use the documentation and the publications of the reports that are already there, but also bringing to bear that need to continue to take testimonies to break the silence because of the ongoing failure under international human rights law.
Thank you, Jane. Christine?
I think the only thing I would add is that I think the tribunal showed very much that part of the failure of justice for the survivors comes from the fact that the peace process completely ignored the situation. The peace process back in 1951, San Francisco peace agreement, and then the separate agreement with the other countries involved. And I think that it's important to see the situation in Syria holistically, and the importance of women's participation across the board. So not just with respect to the issues relating to sexual violence, but all the issues relating to reconstruction, a peace process, peace plan. So the roadmap should be broader than just looking at this particular issue, I think, of justice with respect to sexual violence. Now, obviously, there's sort of a huge number of issues around the various aspects of the peace process, the issues related to bringing women into that. But I think that all of that should be seen as part and parcel of an overall approach towards achieving gender justice across the board. I might add, I just add one other thing? You mentioned the issue of the various powers involved. Well, of course, we also have to remember that Japan was a major power, and that that was an obstacle and an issue. Mina and Isu have talked about that very effectively. But I think we as an international community as well have to remember to keep reminding the Security Council of the obligations they have undertaken within the Women, Peace and Security agenda, and not to just let that disappear in particular context cases such as Syria, or we might say Yemen, you know, other situations of today.
Hesu, you wanted to add in something?
Can I just add very briefly about fundraising events? I am looking at the records of our activities, and there were considerable efforts to raise funds from the Korean communities overseas at that time, especially from Germany, USA, as well as from Japan. So concert, the advocacy effort, publicity about the tribunal, but also fundraising. So if the Syrian civil society organization have a connection with Syrian community living globally, maybe they can be one source. I don't know how close you are connected, but that was one thing that we did for our efforts. Thanks.
Thank you. We've got a second question with very little time left. I'm going to answer the second part of the next question, and then I'm going to turn over to Mina and Hesu for the first part. This is someone from Japan, and one of the issues they raised was the fact that Japanese women who were economically and socially vulnerable, were also sent to comfort stations overseas. I would just point out that even though that issue wasn't raised in the documentary, it certainly was canvassed during the Tokyo Women's Tribunal. So everybody is very well aware that women in that situation from Japan were forced to go into the comfort stations around the Asia Pacific region. But the first question that they asked is, how can we make the Japanese government recognize sexual slavery as a crime against humanity involving 10 countries and not as an issue limited to Japan and South Korea? Hesu, I don't know whether you want to comment on that, and then Mina, you want to offer some observations, because you're from the two affected countries.
So what was the first part of your question?
The first is how can you get the Japanese government to a point where they see this as an issue between them and the whole Asia Pacific region, and not just as an issue between Japan and South Korea?
I think the Japanese government knows very well, and it is the Japanese government's tactic to reduce it to just between Korea and Japan, because they know that the Korean women's movement is the strongest, so that, you know, to reduce the scale. This happens also to our effort to register the documents to UNESCO documentary heritage, because the UNESCO understands that, it's between Korea and Japan, so you settle it. No, but it's not like that. And we are now having discussions with the facilitator appointed by UNESCO. And we try to really emphasize that it's not between Korea and Japan only, but it's between China, Taiwan, Indonesia, Malaysia, East Timor, Philippines, as well as another white people's country, the Netherlands. So I think it's a deliberate tactic, and we should not be tricked by it. And map produced by WAM Museum, Mina, that shows the comfort stations all across Asia Pacific is the proof of that. Yeah.
Thank you. Mina, did you want to add something to that?
One of the reasons why the issue is still alive between Korea and Japan is because Korean civil society is strong enough to push the government of South Korea. Because other countries, for example, the Philippines, East Timor, Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, those countries, they can't, the civil society's group and supporters group are not strong enough to push the government of their country to push the Japanese government. So it's not going to be the diplomatic issue. Then the Japanese government don't recognize that is a victim. There are other issues between the countries. So I was once surprised by the Japanese government reaction that about the East Timor, that because, you know, the East Timor government has never contacted on this issue to the Japanese government. They say they haven't recognized there is a victim in East Timor or something like that. I mean, they consider everything diplomatically, even though they knew they don't want to recognize. So it's, I think one of the reasons that the Korea-Japan issue still alive is the civil society's power in South Korea. But it doesn't mean that other, you know, for example, the Philippines are very strong and demonstrating, but they are not strong enough to push the Philippine government to talk about comfort women issue with the Japanese government in the diplomatic talk. That's how it is like framed by the media. But I don't know, it's one of the reason, but I mean, the concept is probably created by media, and especially the Korean civil society is very strong to put the memorial and all that kind of issue, makes the image that this is Korea-Japan issue, but it's the death document shows this is all Asia Pacific. So we have to make more efforts to convey the image, convey the reality that this was widespread, and we are trying to do it, you know, in every occasion, but the media is a bit difficult to push, to, you know. Hazel, please.
Yeah. Maybe one other factor that we can say why in Korea the movement is strong, and then the government policies reflect the strong movement, is that younger generation is also being educated and participating. For example, in Wednesday demonstrations, every Wednesday noon in front of the Japanese embassy, many young students from elementary school to the college students are participating. And then it is backed by the whole population. So in Korea, the movement is very much alive, not only by women's groups, but also the whole public. Recently, an organization in the southern city of Changwon, which covers Changwon, Masan, Jinhae area, they had a contest, entry contest by young people, students, youth, to create a video art and writing, etc. And over 200 youngsters participated in the contest. I was on the panel of judges for that. So there is a constant interest and enthusiasm and participation by the young generation.
Thank you, Heisu. Just I've got more questions here. And Christine, I think you're probably the best person to start off on the next question. Ever since sexual slavery has been incorporated in various United Nations human rights instruments as one key form of sexual and gender-based violence, and goes on to cite the Rome Statute, etc. Now, the question is, we had that concept of enforced prostitution, which came out of the Versailles Peace Treaty and was used previously. The person wants to know whether or not there's any merit to retaining the concept of enforced prostitution as alongside of sexual slavery, or is it that we should just do away with it because the word prostitution is so stigmatizing? Christine.
A huge question that straddles international humanitarian law, international criminal law, and of course, particularly in the context at the moment of the CEDAW Committee's work on trafficking under Article 6 of the CEDAW Convention. My own personal view is that we need to think about the concept of enslavement leading to sexual slavery and look at the various components of enslavement. Then we also need to look at how trafficking is understood and the concept of exploitation far more broadly than just exploitation of sex, i.e. forced prostitution. And so I think again that these narrow categorizations can in fact lead down to rigid and technical distinctions rather than looking at the nub of what it is, what is the harm that is being caused to the particular person. And I think the harm is enslavement, exploitation, and that's where we need to focus.
Jane, did you want to add any comments to that?
The only thing I would add to what Christine has said is I think the idea of sexual slavery and enslavement crystallizes the whole notion of autonomy and in a way that enforced prostitution may not. You know, ongoing debates around autonomy of sex workers. I think it can create a contradiction there. And I think the notion of human autonomy and integrity, women's autonomy and integrity, is central to focus on, and hence why I would agree with Christine around focusing on slavery, on exploitation, on trafficking, so a much broader prism, if you like.
I would add in, and then I'm afraid I realize as it's been coming through chat that there are other people who want to ask questions, but I think everybody was made aware the session had to end at the end of an hour and a half, and we are almost at time, if I'm reading my time correctly. But as I totally agree with everything that Christine and Jane have just said, but one of the things about having had that enforced prostitution following the Versailles Treaty at the end of the First World War is it goes back to a small issue that was raised in the video, but one that we've discussed much at length, and Jane, you referred to, I think, along the way, is that the Allies could have prosecuted this. Yes. It was already listed as a war crime. And so yes. had they actually been willing to focus in on what had happened to all of these women, they could actually have taken this very seriously and done something in Tokyo immediately after the war. And as far the only country that took it seriously was the Dutch, but only with respect to Dutch women, not Indonesian women. And so again, we come back to the colonization issue that Hesu raised and others raised, and all of those things that end up being tied together. Louise, I'm very well aware that we've got 3 minutes, so I would just like to thank our remarkable panel members for your contributions. They've been absolutely wonderful and illuminating. I'd like to thank Louise for chairing the session, and of course the audience for participating. And hopefully members of the audience have been inspired to take whatever action they think appropriate in the area of sexual violence or discrimination against women and girls. And of course, on behalf of all of us, I'd like to really thank Sophie Mallett for producing this video. And she's been very quiet in the background. Elena, and Elena, I'm going to apologize in advance because I suspect I'm not going to pronounce your surname correctly, Traveska, for helping all of us coordinate this, stay in touch with one another, make sure that we all understood what we were supposed to be doing. So over to you, Louise, to finish off with housekeeping and the December 10th event.
Thank you, Tina. I can also see that there are quite a few other questions that have come in, and unfortunately we are running out of time today. However, and this brings me to one of the two announcements that I wanted to make, and I'm going to take the second one first because it is relevant, that we're actually hosting a second watch party around the film, which is going to be taking place on Thursday, the 10th, this Thursday, from 4 o'clock. That's Greenwich Mean Time, with different panel members, and that's with George McDonald, Ingai Sajor, as well as Professor Patty Sellers, who was the second prosecutor. So any of those who have raised questions that we haven't managed to get to, and they're really important questions, please do join us again on Thursday. And you know, perhaps you can beat the crowd and get in there before everyone else and pose these questions that I'm sure will with the panelists on that on Thursday would be happy to respond to. So going back to the first announcement that I did want to make was that we have also produced two documents that will shortly be posted on our website, comprising key extracts from the judgment itself. The first document comprises some of the voices of the brave women who spoke out. I think that as lawyers, we're all too aware of the fact that the paradox of legal processes is that all too often it is the victims' voices that get drowned out and sometimes even silenced. And so this document actually is out there. We produced it deliberately to draw your attention to the women's voices. The second document comprises key legal passages from the judgment itself. The judgment is huge. So it's an entry point for those of you who want to engage with, you know, what was a really revolutionary judgment. I think it was Indai who said, you know, we gendered international law and this is it. You know, go read that judgment. But this is, you know, as I said, I think it's something, it's quite long, but it is key legal passages from that. So that they will be available on our website. And for those who are interested, we are also sending out emails to let you know when they are actually being posted. Finally, on behalf of the Gender Peace Project, I do want to take this opportunity. Thank you, Tina, for moderating. It was just fabulous. So thank you very much. I mean, like, I would ask the audience to join me now in clapping, but you know, I mean, like, it's just me, but I know that everyone else is there in spirit. Oh yes, everyone is there. Thank you so much. But also, thank you all our panel members for joining us today, and of course, Sophie. But last, but not least of all, the audience. So thank you all who have joined us today. Perhaps we'll see you on Thursday. Thank you very much.